With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS. You're with George Eliason, live from Donbas, Ukraine, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
It's the top of the weekend, and welcome to the George Eliason Show. For the last few days, we've been building out the story around a state capture of Brazil, and what the headline, when we're talking about state capture, I explained the other day. Now, we're going to actually pick the story up and fill it out on Monday and Tuesday. Yes, it's that big. It's that broad, and it's been going on that long. Now, today we've got a special guest after the news segment with Dede Denslow. It's Professor Peter Morici from the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland, and we're going to talk about the WTO and actually what's bad about it. That's going to be an important conversation, and it should be a lot of fun. Now, the next few minutes, I want to discuss how broad-ranging Matthew Pagassi, Dominique Strauss-Kahn's operation has been and how long it's been going on. Now, if we look at Ukraine a little bit, and we'll look at it a lot more next week, going back to the fabled Orange Revolution, Pagassi had one of his guys there. And they were advising on the revolution itself. They brought in SCL, which did information operations, took over the media worldwide, pushed the revolution as a great thing. And do you know who was leading the way during that revolution? It was the godmother of Ukrainian politics. Her name is Slava Stetsko. You don't know who she is. Well, I've mentioned her a few times. Slava was the head of OUNB, or the Bandera worldwide, from the mid-1980s when her husband died until she passed away. And I believe it was 2003. Now, her husband planned and started two pogroms in the city of Lviv during World War II in March 1941. That was to celebrate his declaring a Ukrainian state in what was West Ukraine at the time. Yeah, think about it. Hey, this is a happy day. Let's go kill a bunch of people. Why not? And he actually named them, gave them names in honor of genocides that happened in Lviv like 20 years before. He named it after him. I mean, it doesn't get any better than this. Now, their group, the Stetsko's group, as Bandera, volunteered to kill everybody at all the Holocaust camps all across Europe. That's what they did. I mean, they jumped at the chance and volunteered. And everybody else backed away because, you know, nobody, German soldiers didn't want to kill people. They were soldiers. These are unarmed people. And a lot of the other groups that were bound with the Third Reich passed it down too, but not these people, not the Bandera. And they went across Ukraine, killing everybody there, and followed the Wehrmacht around everywhere they went and killed everyone behind them too. I mean, that's just a happy day for these guys. Now, in 2001, 2002, she came back to Kiev. She took over politics. Now, can you imagine being a Nazi leader, a literally Nazi, World War II Nazi leader, responsible for all that murder, all the murders in the country that you're taking a seat in government in? Bada bing, bada boom. And she's the godmother of politics in Ukraine. she was behind the Orange Revolution, and when it didn't do the deed and deliver a Bandera Ukraine, her and her compatriot, the head of the other OUN faction, it was Melnik, OUNM, said that if they didn't create a nationalist Ukraine like they promised, then their followers would, from the diaspora, would create another coup, and these people probably wouldn't survive it. Now, who didn't survive it? Well, they got rid of Yanukovych, who's also a nationalist. You don't take a government seat in Ukraine without being one. OUNM or OUNB. 2014, OUNM was kicked out, OUNB took over, and that's what happened. So when we look at it in that context, and you have these regime changers coming in, now, what did they want? What did a guy like Pagassi want? What did he need? They took over at that point because they were successful over 30% of Ukraine's banks became theirs. They sold them out. They took over the entire internet structure, all the companies. You want internet? It flows through the people Pagassi negotiated the sale with. They're his guys. They do what he wants. So when 2014 came around, this whole thing with destroying the free press, they already had the infrastructure the free press worked on. They had everything, the banking system, everything. What actually could work? Absolutely nada. Now, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have Dede Denslow. Next week, we'll pick up on this, and you're going to see that regime after regime after regime change. These are the bankers and people behind it, and there's a method to their madness. Now, if you've missed your favorite show on TNT or an interview, simply listen back when you want, wherever you want. Just visit episodes on the TNT Radio website. We're also on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbeam, iHeart, and TuneIn. Now, there's no reason to miss out on anything on TNT Radio.
There's a lot going on, so it's important to stay informed and up to date.
Get ready, because here we go.
At the top, 30 minutes past, and when it breaks.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to host and producer Dede Denslow with today's news. Dede, what's going on in the world?
Yes, it's hi, George. Good to be speaking to you, and happy Friday. I hope you have a great weekend when it finally gets here.
You
and it's
too,
quite interesting.
You too.
It was quite interesting that you was talking about the Nazis in Ukraine. There is an article out today. Meta, which is Facebook, makes balance decision on Ukrainian neo-Nazi regiment. Content about the notorious Azov regiment will be freely posted on Facebook and Instagram, again, Kiev has claimed. The Azov Regiment, a controversial Ukrainian unit with close ties to the far-right movements around the world, will no longer be suppressed on platforms owned by the US tech giant Meta, a Ukrainian minister has claimed. The pledge to change policy was purportedly made to Ukrainian officials by none other than ex-United Kingdom Deputy Prime Minister and a liberal, Nick Clegg, Meta President of Global Affairs, and Monica Bicker, the head of Global Policy Management at Facebook, during a meeting at the WEF in Davos. Ukrainian Digital Transformation Minister Mikhail Fedorov, who broke the news on Thursday, thanked Meta for a balanced and important decision, remarking that Facebook and Instagram, two social media platforms operated by Meta, were powerful tools for spreading the truth. So this will be spreading the truth that's coming out of the mouths of potential Nazis. Azov Regiment originated as a right-wing Ukrainian nationalist militia, which coalesced after the 2014 armed coup in Kiev. the new regime deployed the army to suppress a rebellion in the east that rejected its rule. Something that you obviously are very familiar with, George. That formation became the core of a wider Azov movement, which has its own political party and a cadre of activists dubbed the Civil Corps. For years, it was considered by many observers to be a dangerous right-wing organization. An expose by Time magazine in January 2021 reported that online recruitment and propaganda on Facebook allowed the Ukrainian movement to become the hub of a network of extremist groups stretching from California across Europe to New Zealand. The online platform first designated as of a dangerous organization in 2016, Facebook's efforts to suppress its content were not successful. This designation as a dangerous organization has now been lifted, George. But if you're Trump, you're not allowed to use. If you're a Nazi, you can use Facebook. If you're a Ukrainian Nazi, because that's an okay Nazi, if you're from Ukraine. But if you're Trump, you can't use Facebook. If you're somebody who's upset about vaccine mandates, you can't put that on Facebook. But the Azov Battalion, that's perfectly acceptable. And this is permission that's been given to Ukraine by ex-Deputy PM Nick Clegg, George.
Well, yeah, exactly. And believe it or not, the manager at Facebook in charge of clamping down on speech, which is kicking everybody off of Facebook, is actually Ukrainian. And so are a lot of the fact checkers that they use. They're out of Lviv. Now, the head of Azov, the founder of it, Andrei Belitsky, I talked about Slava Stetsko at the top of the hour, because of her relationship to these bankers, et cetera, et cetera. It's very important. Her political party, when she came back to Ukraine, was called the Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists. She had a militant wing of a group, and the group was called Trizub. Andrei Belitsky, the founder of Azov, was a regional leader. He learned his politics directly from a World War II Nazi.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that, you know, Azov, and this is my understanding of the Azov Battalion, at least their core members, that they are, in terms of ideology, are effectively direct descendants of the Third Reich that operated during the 30s and the 40s. Is that a correct assumption? Is that an exaggeration that they're, you know, they are effectively descendants of the original Nazis and they're not neo-Nazis, as they're often described in the mainstream press, who, by the way, derided this group all the way up until the turn of 2022, George?
They're a little bit different because they celebrate Ukrainian Nazism. You had Ukrainian SS battalions, and you had the Ukrainian death camp volunteers. Now, when you see the death's head on the, and that's a pretty famous logo on Azov's helmets, okay? That death's head's logo is them celebrating their grandfathers who committed the Holocaust, because that's what they were. They were called the Troniki men and Death Head's SS battalion. So they're in the Third Reich, but they were Ukrainian nationalists. Germany was just a vehicle for them, you know, in that sense. And they love doing that. They just love doing that kind of work, murdering innocent people. I mean, you know, how happier could the day be, right? It's incredible.
It's incredible. And it's I'm looking at a statement from a Meta spokesperson who has said the war in Ukraine has meant changing circumstances in many areas, and it has become clear that the Azov Regiment does not meet our strict criteria for designation as a dangerous organization. And now I have you, George, who's actually situated in the Donbass. I take complete, you know, I take your direction on anything going on in Ukraine because you're there. You're saying that these are people who like to go around murdering people, and grandparents were part of the same group that committed the Holocaust. And me, as a taxpayer in the UK, a taxpayer in the US, are sending billions to support and finance their movement and their fight against a country who has vowed to end Nazism on its border. It disgusts me. I wish the general public were aware of this because there would be much greater backlash to the war. The Azov story's gone a bit quiet, I have to say, on social media and in the mainstream media, probably because they keep parading around with Nazi symbols on their uniforms.
That's exactly it.
It's disgusting. It appalls me. And now Meta has said it's okay for them to put their propaganda on their platform. I'm lost for words.
Here's a kicker, too. In that same article that you were quoting from 2021, Christopher Wray stated, Azov has already committed terrorist acts in the United States. Well, what terrorist acts? They're backing up Antifa. They're part of the violence backing them up. And this was just after the J6 riot at the Capitol. And there's video of Ukrainians moving in a military found a formation doing two of the three break-ins. They're speaking freaking Ukrainian. How much easier does this get? How much easier? Followed by a major Ukrainian TV station filming this. How much easier does this get? And yet, we'll ignore all that and call everything good, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're doing in my country. They're just pretending they never, ever reported on the Nazis in Ukraine. That it never happened. They've tried to bury all their sort of previous news reports and footages and articles. And for a good first 9 months of the conflict in Ukraine, we're supporting the Azov battalion as freedom fighters. It appalls me. And when you think of the censorship of far less serious groups or people on these social media platforms, for them to designate Azov as not a dangerous organization, I find deeply worrying, George.
Well, let's make another note on this too. Do you remember when they were coming out of Azovstal, the steel plant? The Russians finally rooted them out and they were leaving the plant, right? So they're walking out of the plant. Did you know that the Russian army and the Donetsk army actually had to protect Azov from the civilians that lived there? Civilians wanted to beat them to death with sticks because of what they'd done to them for the previous 8 years.
I've seen lots of commentary on social media, on video of members of who claim to be Ukrainian, the members of the public who are based in the east of Ukraine, complaining about how saying that the Russians are liberating them from people who have been terrorizing them for 8 years. But again, none of this gets put on mainstream. And if that person complaining, like you've just mentioned, was put on Facebook, it would probably be censored, George.
Well, probably. All right. Didi, thank you for coming by today. I'm looking forward to what you have to say on the Monday show. You have a great weekend. George. We're going to take a quick break, and Peter Maurice is next up.
You should hear what Jason Allborn is talking about.
Fascism can be defined as a governmental system led by a dictator having complete power, forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism, regimenting all industry, commerce, and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism and often racism. Although what we're seeing now in new fascism is that nationalism is being replaced by globalism. And in fact, nationalism is the enemy of globalism. So if you're not happy with all the World Economic Forum, World Health Organization, United Nations, etc., you may find out that you are indeed a nationalist. And back in the day, if you said you're a nationalist, people would automatically call you somebody with the initials of AH, who used to come from Germany. But you can't say these words anymore for fear that you may be handcuffed and locked away in all eternity, because history apparently doesn't mean anything anymore.
Jason Allborn and Jason Q. Citizen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio
and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Internet. A stream online.
tntradio.live. Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Welcome back, and we've got Professor Peter Morici of the Robert H. Smith School of Business, University of Maryland, and that's College Park campus. Yes, Peter?
Yes, I'm technically at College Park, though I'm broadcasting from my home because nobody works where they're supposed to anymore.
Oh, gosh. I remember College Park as being, it was just really, really pretty. During the time I was down that way. Now, we're going to talk about your Washington Times article, "The World Trade Organization is Worse Than Useless, Board Up the Windows in Geneva and Send the Bureaucrats Home."
Yeah.
What's going on with this?
Well, dispute settlement is really broken. It's been impossible to enforce any rules with regard to China's mercantilism and industrial targeting and so forth. And that was frustrating, and that's what caused the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations to not go along with the appointment of some and then all judges for the appellate body. But the panels still go on. The dispute settlement panels still go on. There's just no appeals, or the appeals are taken to some, you know, international arbitration tribunal. In some recent decisions, after the Russian invasion of the Crimea, disrupted trade between the Ukraine and nations further east, former Soviet states. And the World Trade Organization found, the dispute settlement body found essentially that, well, Russia is in a state of war with Ukraine, and therefore it's entitled to do as it pleases under the national security exemption. You can do things you would not otherwise be able to do because of a national security exemption. And that's really never
been. What was this finding?
Now, hold on. This gets worse. So, you know, Russia gets to disrupt trade because it invades a country. Then the Americans, as you know, impose tariffs on Chinese and other steel under the notion that steel is necessary to have a domestic industry to support its military. Now, you and I can have a long discussion as to whether that was a good idea or not. I mean, there's lots of different views on that. But whether it is actionable by the WTO or not, you know, and under what circumstances is critical. And the WTO said, since the United States is not in a state of war, it cannot access the national security exclusion. For example, it can't promote through subsidies its semiconductor industry with the logical extension of that. And what it's doing to China with regard to semiconductors, that is denying them access for their military machinery to produce the most advanced ones, is not legal under the WTO because it's not in a state of war with China. So if the WTO can say Russia can do what it pleases because it invades Ukraine, and the United States can't see to it that it has a suitable industrial base in case it goes to war. There's something very peculiar is going on here with this body. But then again, if you look at the hard left, the progressives in Congress, they inclined to say we shouldn't be supporting Ukraine. And we should be seeking to collaborate with the Chinese rather than confront them, to cooperate with them. I mean, the hard left in America, you know, has become the fifth column when it comes to commercial law. And if you look at who's running the WTO these days, the director general and so forth, she's a bleeding heart for the left. You know, it's become very fashionable to emphasize social justice, race and gender essentialism and so forth at the IMF, the WTO and so forth. Look at the faces representing them, you know, at Davos this week. So, you know, in this environment, it's very hard to say that the WTO culturally, or even as it's been implementing its rules with basically these dispute settlement panels are have on them people like myself, former trade bureaucrats. I was chief economist in the National Trade Commission in the United States in a previous life. People like myself on those panels, if they're coming to these conclusions that it's okay for Russia to invade Ukraine and cut off its trade, and it's not okay for the United States to see to it has a domestic semiconductor industry, I want no part of the place. At that point, as my article concludes, there's only one reasonable thing to do with the WTO. Plywood and nails. Board up the windows and send the bureaucrats home. No more good lunches in Switzerland on the Americans. So much for, you know.
Well, let's start with Trump, work back to China, and then we can handle Ukraine. Now, in your article, the Trump administration imposed a 25% tariff on steel, 10% tariff on several nations, citing the necessity to maintain an industrial base. Now, he didn't cite the Article 21 exception, the GATT Article 21 exception, as relating to traffic in arms, ammunition, implements of war, or did he with that? I mean, it is part of arming the military. You need to steal for tanks.
That was our defense in the WTO, was that this falls under the national defense exclusion. And it was taken as a national defense act. That's why it probably that's the only way you could justify what Trump did constitutionally or legally, because President's not supposed to be able to raise tariffs on his own, but national security, national defense is an executive prerogative. And generally speaking, presidents get to break all kinds of rules. For example, I don't know that it is technically legal, you know, to really do all the things to China that we're doing right now. But given the national defense and security considerations, there's a tendency to all the gray areas become white for presidents, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, you know, and probably that's a good thing. Or issues get pigeonholed until the problem passes. Now, that can be abused, like in the case of immigration from Mexico, or the student loans. Student loans were in a perpetual state of emergency from COVID. Well, the state of emergency from COVID has passed.
Now, here's a question. It's kind of a sidebar on that because I think it can be problematic even because when you bring non-security issues up as security issues, was student loans a security issue? Was it something that the president should be able to do outside of law, make it a gray area? And if they do that, why is there no mechanism where they have to provide a justification? I mean, if they want to go on an excursion, a military excursion, they have to provide a justification within 90 days. Okay, that's making that type of security decision.
Well, the law with regard to
national emergencies.
Yeah, the law with regard to national emergencies basically throws that to the courts. If somebody does something, if a president does something that you don't feel that an offended party does not view as justifiable. And for example, the states have disputed the student loan suspensions and now the changes in the student loan provisions, permanent changes in court. You know, that's where you get your redress, because it basically says under these circumstances, you can do X, Y, and Z. That's what the statutes say. So, and I'm not a lawyer, remember, I'm an economist. And so when a president acts under the statutes, then you can take him to court. Did he follow administrative law effectively, which requires that you have, a period for comments by affected parties? And was he justified in doing what he was doing? And there's a whole kind of list of the courts have developed a list of conditions under which the president is on strong ground or weak ground when he does these things. The president can take action in a national emergency, but if he oversteps his bounds, the courts are supposed to pull him in. But you have to have somebody with standing to take him to court. Rule number one,
president's the tricky part.
Time can do anything they want until someone takes him to court or impeaches them.
I've had a lot of guests on, and we're talking about the Nixon administration, and you know, a lot of cases like that. And it is, as long as it is a security issue, there's really no bounds there. So, which is, it's good, and you know, it could come back and bite us in the ass at different times, depending on what it is and, you know, the condition of the president's mind. You know, do you want, you know, Joe Biden, you know, for instance? That's kind of a little unnerving that he, you know, might have or use or abuse that kind of power.
In an era of a polarized Congress, unlike, say, in the Nixon era, it's more of a problem because Congress is less likely to act to haul in the president. You know, either if he's got a majority in both houses, they're going to let him do what he pleases. And that's not necessarily a good thing. If he doesn't have a majority in one house, then they're going to go after him everything he does. You know, unless the Chinese are, you know, bombing Pearl Harbor or they're crossing the Straits of Taiwan, they're going to go after him on everything. And so there isn't sort of this consensus in Congress that it has an interest, you know, that there's congressional power to be preserved or congressional prerogatives to be preserved. The other thing is, it's states' rights, and I don't want to now be associated with, you know, all the bad things that have happened under the banner of states' rights, but the Constitution really did delineate the powers of the central government, and there has been a tendency for the central government to just do whatever it wants. And the only real check on that has been the conservative wing of the Supreme Court. I mean, for example, why do we have a Department of Education issuing mandates? Now, you might not like the mandates, or you might like the mandates, but that's not the business of the federal government. Education is a state enterprise. Voting rights is a state enterprise. The Constitution is quite clear as to who determines who gets to vote. It basically says that electors for Congress, this is voters, not electors like the president.
The Electoral College.
The electors for Congress shall meet in each state the requirements for the electors of the larger body in the state legislature. So in all the states, except I think it's Nebraska, that's bicameral, that's unicameral, that's basically the General Assembly. So if you can vote for the General Assembly, you can vote for the House of Representatives. But who determines who can vote for the House of Representatives? That's the prerogative of the state governments, not the federal government. And, you know, the notion that the Voting Rights Act is still in play when in Georgia, you know, you can reasonably argue that Black Lives Matter was late to the party in terms of asserting the rights of blacks, that you know, if you feel that white males are already oppressed, then all you have to do is try to get a contract from the city of Atlanta and you've got, you know, proof you want. And that existed long before, you know, Black Lives Matters and all the rest of that stuff, or AOC decided to stop tending bar.
yeah.
You know, or whatever her alternative employment might be, you know, with Nancy, it's nagging her husband. But whatever that might be, you know, on the Republican side, there are bad people. Those things shouldn't be in there. You shouldn't have those things in play without a compelling need. And there is no longer a compelling need for the Voting Rights Act.
Right. Right. I agree. And on the basis of what you said, it's very, very clear because it is the states. You can't have federal reform. It is state level. Every state needs to decide. And that's just a fact. So There are things that people can do, you know, and this is an outside case, reining in, you know, that power if it gets out of line or it gets wacky. Now, in your article, you also talked about China subverting the rule by, and this is important, forcing foreign investors to transfer intellectual property. Of course, they're massively subsidizing domestic industries. It's a communist, but the for semiconductors. So if you're looking at like an Apple iPhone and the technology in there, was that's transferred to China or as a partner? How does that work?
Well, basically, they close the market. Quite apart from whatever tariffs they have, they make it impossible to sell stuff made here, there. And there's a lot of ways to do that other than tariffs, you know, just by imposing technical standards, inspections at the border, you know, things of that nature. You go, wee, I just need to make the stuff there. I mean, India is notorious for that. Okay? So you have to make the stuff there in order to sell there. Okay, so we'll make it there. Well, then you have to get a permit to do that. You have to be permitted into the country. And the Chinese will then say, well, what are you going to do for local technology? You know, are you going to train local engineers? Are you going to employ local engineers? As soon as you start employing local engineers in your R&D labs, you're transferring technology because they learn it and they go work someplace else. I mean, you know, non-compete clauses don't go very far in a foreign country. That's how it's done. Or you basically are going to teach us how to do something. Another ploy they have is joint venture partners. In order to get in the automobile industry over there, you had to have a joint venture partner. And that would basically be a state-owned, you know, car maker. And so you bring them in as partners and you teach them how to make cars. Now, they have learned how to make cars. They've learned how to make good cars. And they have now subsidized electric vehicles. So they're ahead on that. Now, part of the reason they're ahead on that is Trump was sleeping at the switch on that one. If Trump was ever a disappointment, it was on electric vehicles. You know, he really was. I would go to the West Wing, you know, and make a little presentation and then, you know, to Mnuchin and Kudlow and Lighthizer and the bunch. And immediately I'd be told the president wants, quote, a level playing field. That means you can't do anything for electric vehicles that you don't do for gas-powered vehicles. That's okay. If the world isn't going to electric, which it's going to do, you can't stop that. And the other countries are subsidizing the crap out of it, which they are.
China, I've actually seen that China is investing heavily in eVTOL taxis, airlifts. Forget about the cars. We're talking about, you know, Jetson style flying people around. Yeah. That's a step beyond. And they're almost ready to introduce them into China.
That market's going to be limited. Now, just a second. That market's going to be limited because just like the market for electric vehicles faces formidable barriers in the city of New York. Because how can you have, you know, think of that if 10% of the cars in New York City were flying and they were up in the air, how would we keep them from running into each other?
Oh, exactly.
So they're not going to be alone.
We're talking what's really about the actual
electric vehicles. That's different. Electric vehicles matter. Mm-hmm. And we're challenged when it comes to that because we commute in them much more than the Chinese do. And that makes it more difficult. For example, if you live in Queens in New York City and you live in one of those star-shaped apartment towers, where are you going to plug in? Can we assign each vehicle to parking space and then give it something that looks like a taxi meter to plug into? Where are you going to plug it in?
As an economist, now we're talking about dollar figures here. That's right up your alley. What would it cost to update the U.S. infrastructure to be able to handle electric vehicles, forget about the flying, you know, super stuff, but just electric vehicles nationwide. Well, how much money would it cost?
More than there are stars in the sky. Because it's not just the money to install the plugs and the money to install the generating capacity, whether you do windmills or natural gas or by collecting the droppings of buffaloes in North Dakota and fermenting them, there's the issue of building the transmission lines. And there you run into the regulatory regulatory issues, and the people, the very wokey of the wokists, the wokey wokies of the world, are scientists who work for, you know, people like, you know, these environmental organizations, because they're completely detached from the reality of running a large economy and what their prescriptions would mean. You know, the city planners who want everybody to, you know, have electric skateboards to go to work, you know, they're the Excel crowd. They went to Harvard, and they're very literate. They were right for Bloomberg. They've never considered what it would mean for a city of 12 million people to do that. How could they ever live close enough to do those things? Those people, you know, they like to bring lawsuits and hold things up. Like, it took forever to bring electricity from Quebec, you know, to get the permitting done to bring hydroelectric from Quebec to New York City. That's finally going to get done. So if you factor in the time that it's going to take to truly electrify the country, that is to get rid of the gas cars, to get rid of the gas stoves, to get rid of the gas heat and so forth. I mean, just assuming that's a good thing. Let's give them that. I don't know how you build all the electric lines. Now, to give you an idea, just the perversions this creates, they're using old coal-fired plants, the sites, as places to hub solar power, because they already have lines, so they don't have to get permits to build new lines. The trouble is, if you look at where plants are, right, I couldn't believe it. I was reading, you know, what you do with old coal power plants, putting them to good use. Bloomberg ran an article on that this week, you know, as if they had discovered something. You know, these guys remind me of when I was a kid, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, the teacher says you can't have a perpetual motion machine. They immediately tell you you can have one. You know, they give you, you know, the engine will pull this, will pull that, will pull that. And you say, what about friction? And the kid goes, what's friction? Okay. Well, it's amazing. PhDs that work for, you know, the Sierra's Club and so forth, you know, never heard of friction, because they are the manufacturers of friction. There's such a thing as socioeconomic friction.
Wow.
And the left specializes in it. It's the tax they impose on everything. So many things they want to stop get done anyway, but only at much greater cost. And that's one of the reasons, for example, it takes four or five times as much money to build a mile of subway in the United States or a new station in New York City than it does in a comparable city in Europe like Paris. Believe it or not, the French are five times as efficient at building subway lines and stations than the Americans. Now, when France is five times as efficient as you are, you're not just Italy.
That's not good.
You're Upper Uganda.
That's,
you know,
not good.
Upper Uganda doesn't. You're Uganda now. In fact, you're Uganda in the countryside with a yak, you know, pulling a steel shaft plow without irrigation. That's what you become.
Now, you know, along with the lines, they're going to have to upgrade infrastructure to carry the lines. It's not, you know, as simple as that ungodly amount of money. Bridges, you're looking at bridges just to get the.
Oh, wait, have you heard?
Carry the lines.
Oh, what's the Secretary of Transportation, the mayor of South Bend, Buttigieg?
Yeah.
He's pushed through a rule on the infrastructure bill that we can't use any of the infrastructure money to build new roads and bridges. We can only use it to do repairs.
Oh, thank God.
Now,
oh, wow.
Well, hold on a second. Think of what that means. But this is like, you know, because he's obsessed with the notion that new roads create new drivers and more pollution. True, they do, if you use gas-powered cars. And that's true. But on the other hand, another, you know, say another cubbyhole, you know, if you got this great big Zoom meeting and everybody's in a little box. So he's in one box and he's obsessed about cars. In another box, there's a person that's obsessed about social justice and housing. Well, guess what? You can't expand America's housing stock and reduce the price of housing in America's metro areas unless you build roads. Because you can only go so much up. So they are basically creating another barrier to justice in the housing market.
And here's something else
it's mind-boggling. Explain that to them. Explain that to them. They just get angry.
Before
I was on the state
before I moved to Ukraine.
Excuse me?
And we're going, before I moved to Ukraine, and we're going back to 2009, I was an infrastructure contractor. I did heavy highway stuff. Specifically, I did bridge foundations, that kind of thing. Wow. Now you're looking at, okay, they're going to, you know, rebuild the bridges and stuff. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. We were looking at a bridge and we're driving a test sheet. You know what sheet pile looks like, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The bridge broke loose of the bolts. They weren't there anymore. It was just rust. And the beam started moving.
Oh, that's
We had
nice.
To stop everything. Oh, it got cowboys. We've got this sheet. We've got it unhooked off of the clamps, okay? It's in the hammer. This is a 60-foot sheet pile. And we have to drop it. So, you know, of course, we move it away from the road. Okay, but I mean, this thing comes down, when it hits, you don't know where it's going. And oh my gosh. But all of a sudden, that bridge that was good to go, that they were thinking about replacing, was shut down. And we weren't actually in what would be considered an action zone. We weren't right up against it. The sheet pile was about 20 feet away from it. And it started moving the bridge around. That's the condition of state roads in the United States. And so, you know, what's repair? Is it after the bridge falls? I mean, it strikes me as it's not just negligent. It's almost homicidal. Well, we'll just wait until people die. I mean, is that it? Then we'll fix it.
It's become too expensive to repair anything because of all the conditions and requirements imposed on federal highway money, all the wokeism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 40% of the benefits has to flow to previously marginalized groups and things of that nature. It's all obscene in terms of how costly it is to use a federal dollar. You know, I used to say I used to have what I called Maurice's second law, which was whatever I can do for myself for a dollar, the government can do almost as well for $2.50. But with inflation, it's probably 11.
Exactly.
You know, and it gets worse and worse. Yeah, it's kind of like what Joe Biden forgot. That was McMullen's first law. McMullen's first law was you can talk about something or keep it a secret, but you can't do both. I'm afraid his documents have violated that law. You know, don't you think all this business about documents is real? I know you're supposed to ask the questions, but I'm going to ask. Don't you think business about documents and for either Trump or Biden is so much ado about nothing? Presidents and vice presidents carry around documents. And a good deal of the stuff in these documents is silly. Like I remember when I was in the government, had top security clearance. I'd be given a portfolio when I was in the Department of Energy as a young man, which I read in the space you were supposed to read it in and gave it back like a good boy. And when I was at the ITC, you know, I would do the same. But some of the stuff that I would see would just, why are you classifying it? You know, give me a folder and there's an article from Time magazine in there about, you know, oil security. Why are you classifying that? So the guy told me, the guy more senior than me when I was a young guy, said to me, well, Peter, it's not just what's in the folder. We don't want the Russians to know that we're making a folder on that subject. Oh, I see. The people at the USA Canada Institute haven't figured out that we're obsessed about oil security. After all, that's why we, you know, invented the Federal Energy Administration. This was when I was in FEA, which then became DOE. Mm-hmm. And I said, really, they don't know that we are really concerned about oil security. Golly, I'll be sure not to mention that in any bars because I've seen those loose talk movies about the Manhattan Project because there's always a Rusky at the end of the bar taking copious notes.
Well, come on. With some agencies.
So there's a lot of they classify everything as sun. Now, I understand that they may have had stuff, you know, in the garage with the Jaguar that, you know, you don't want getting out. But I would venture to guess this is one of those laws that if you really enforced it on everybody who violated it, it'd be impossible for a former chief executive not to holder of the highest office in the land as Richard Nixon would put it, not to end up in the hoosegow. You know, it's just getting silly. It's kind of like Donald Trump exaggerating the worth of his properties. I'm no fan of what Donald Trump did, okay? You know, when he goes in for a mortgage in one direction and then in another direction when he files his taxes. You mean to tell me he's the only real estate developer or businessman in the state of New York that has done that? And the state attorney general that doesn't have time, resources, or inclination to prosecute murders in black neighborhoods where black women are getting knocked off at a terribly high rate. She doesn't have resources for that, but she's got resources to chase down, you know, whether Donald Trump committed basically a civil violation towards mm-hmm. the Chase Manhattan Bank or something. After all, if anybody should be pursuing Donald Trump for exaggerating the value of his real estate on a loan application, it should be the bank. But, you know,
right.
But that to me is prima facie. This is all political. You know, if you've got
See, that's the problem they created for Biden. And the difference is that, you know, as you said earlier, the chief executive can basically, he has the reign to do what he or she wants. So declassifying anything, that's his prerogative. But yeah, that's but where it ends, the similarities.
There's got to be a paper trail for that to be valid. You know, they have to fill out the form. He has to sign it.
They're actually debating that right now. I would have thought so too.
The whole thing from the Danny Kaye movie, you know, with the grand poobah and everything, and sing the music and everything. The piano didn't play. The piano didn't play for Donald Trump. So did Donald Trump violate the law? Yes. Did Joe Biden violate the law? Yes. Is this de minimis? Probably, because show me something that really got out that was hurtful.
Well, the entire dog and pony show that they did with the Mar-a-Lago thing and turning it into, you know, a big political drama. This is, you know, and this is something that I'm really sorry. I really debate on it. I can see how a lot of these people want payback. I can see that. But there's a point where we've got to get back on to the business of running the country and get the government back to where it's just dysfunctional again.
Well, okay,
you know, like it was 30 years ago.
One of the things we could do is repeal the Voting Rights Act, because that created an enormous incentive to create radicalized congressional districts and to create some mathematical rules for apportioning congressional districts. So they're sort of based on being, you know, reasonably compact. And you run the computer and it spits out the congressional districts. It would likely even out in terms of how it advantages Republicans versus Democrats. This is some states the Republicans get their way and some states the Democrats get their way with reapportionment. But this way you would have more, you know, contended districts. Right now, as Nancy Pelosi said, the Democratic Party could nominate a glass of water in AOC's district and it would get elected.
Right.
No, and that's a problem because then basically the most radical person or the prettiest young bartender gets elected. And then Bloomberg canonizes them. You know, I mean, before AOC, we only used the initial thing. Like, I'm PGM. No one's ever called me PGM. You had to be president of the United States to get that. JFK, LBJ, so forth. You know, but now, you know, they just, see, did they ever do any Democrats that were Republicans that way? We had JFK, FDR. I think only Democrats get that because the press does that canonizing. It's like only the Catholic Church, you know, creates saints. only the media. Because
how about Ike? Ike? Three letters.
Well, that was his slogan. I like Ike.
Uh-huh.
But that's not his initials. You know what that was? You have to remember, all your journalism students have to take economics in most legitimate colleges. Let me tell you something. getting some of these journalism students through economics is difficult.
I'd imagine so. I would imagine so.
I'm only hypothesizing that Ike became what you called Eisenhower. It was too many letters in a row for the typical journalism student to memorize. They couldn't spell it.
You're so
they
probably made him right. Ike. Listen, we're out of time. I'm really looking forward to talking about Ukraine. I want to have you back soon. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you about Ukraine. I've been writing a lot about it. You chose to pick this article, but I'm all for giving them a lot more than just Leopard tanks. Is it Leopards they call them?
Okay. Yeah, and I'm obviously not for that. And that would be a great discussion.
I'm sorry, you got to end. Go ahead. Go ahead.
We've had Peter Morici today, and this Professor Peter Morici, and this has been a great conversation about the World Trade Organization. We'll see you next time, and we'll have him back soon. Thank you so much for coming by.
Take care. All the best.